Well, would you like to be safely prosperous or really rich? Well, that's a new book by Howard Ruff. We'll be with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Howard Ruff is an author, financial advisor, as well as the founder, editor of the Ruff Times Financial Newsletter. In 1975, Howard began publication of the Ruff Times, a groundbreaking financial advisory newsletter. By 1981, the Ruff Times had become the largest financial advisory newsletter in the world. He published his first financial book, How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years, in late 1978. This was followed by two more bestsellers and a syndicated television show called Ruff House. Mr. Ruff's popularity is due to his ability to reduce complex financial subjects into very easy-to-understand terms for Main Street, not Wall Street. His new book, Safely Prosperous or Really Rich, Howard Ruff. Hi, Howard. How are you? Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here. Good. Although, welcome back to the program. It's my first time with you.
I've talked about you on the show before.
I know, you talked about me. In fact, this is the first time I've ever heard you. I wasn't driving in my car somewhere late at night.
Howard, you know, the old saying, these are the best of times, the worst of times, for all of us financially. Where are we?
Well, we're in the best of times and the worst of times, I think. I think you put it very well indeed. I think the essence of the story is that I'm an optimist. I really am. I'm considered to be a gloomy pessimist because I wrote that How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years, and everybody ignored the How to Prosper part and talked about the coming bad years. But I'm an optimist, and an optimist, in my opinion, is one who sees silver linings in dark clouds. And right now, we're running into some dark clouds where the traditional way of life, the traditional investments, are not going to be working for a few years, but there are silver linings and golden linings in those dark clouds. And I think that it's times like this, when we're moving into really important turning points that much of the world will consider negative, certainly Wall Street will consider it negative, is an opportunity to build fortunes. There are fortunes that are built in the worst of times.
And that's the key to all of this. You got to know when to pounce. You got to know when to hold back. It's almost like a good poker game, isn't it?
Well, it takes guts. It really does. And there's a lot of self-confidence involved. And so I've always been attracted to those people who are willing to be mavericks, who are willing to go left when everybody's looking right. And I think the essence of what I'm dealing with now, where I'm right now, for example, I'm bearish on real estate. But heck, there's some real opportunities there and some good things to do, even though I believe the bubble's bursting.
Well, when you say bearish but good opportunities, how do we know, people without a lot of experience here, how do we know the good deals from the bad ones?
Well, it's not so much opportunities in terms of good deals. It's what are you going to do with the house you live in? In the last few years when the Federal Reserve brought the interest rates down to near zero, boy, there was an orgy of people refinancing and taking the money by borrowing against their cash, and which was inflating people buying bigger houses and inflating real estate. And consequently, the bubble blew up to the point that where people found themselves that they had created a serious problem for themselves. For example, a large percentage of all those mortgages were ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages.
Right.
Where if interest rates go up, up go mortgage payments. They were borrowing right up to the hilt. And then if the price of real estate drops, they're going to find themselves in trouble. So what do you do with that? Is there an opportunity here? Sure. The real opportunity is to protect yourself. And I think you protect yourself by converting that ARM and those interest rate only mortgages into fixed rate mortgages so that your interest rates so that your mortgage rates can't go up with interest rates. And also, there's going to be a time when if you own rental properties, you're going to find it's a good time because a lot of people are going to be renting. A lot of people are not going to be buying houses. A lot of people, some people, and a much higher percentage are going to be foreclosing and needing to rent.
Would you buy foreclosed property right now, Howard, if you were investing for real estate?
Only if I got a heck of a deal, because I think real estate prices are going to come down a lot lower. You know, I'll buy anything if it's cheap enough. I'll sell anything if it's expensive enough. And I don't believe it's cheap enough. Right now, we're still near the peak. When these real estate bubbles burst, there are some signs it's bursting. There are things that happen. For example, the listing books get thicker, takes longer to sell a home, and so forth. And the last thing that happens is the price has actually come down, even though people are taking longer and longer to sell their homes. Why? Because they have trouble believing that their home is not worth as much now as it was last month. Consequently, falling prices are the last thing to happen. For example, let's take Southern California. Southern California has been in a horrendous real estate boom. I mean, people have doubled the value of their homes
in
2 or 3 years.
I moved out there in 2003, and I got to tell you, the price of a house there compared to St. Louis, where I go back and forth, absolutely unbelievable. The difference, I can't count it. It's so high.
Well, the important thing is that at a time, this is not a time to be buying real estate. This is a time to be waiting for bargains. And I believe that it's going to create opportunity with much lower prices as they get back into some kind of sanity. And the interesting thing to remember about markets, and this is a principle I've learned of my 30 years in this business, when things get out of proportion either way, when they turn around and go the other way, then they move to excess in direct proportion to how far they were in excess on the other end. For example, if prices go too high, well, then fine. When they go down, they'll probably go down far enough to be too low.
And how do you know that, Howard? How do you know when to jump in? You know, a lot of people may say, okay, I believe Howard Ruff. I'm going to buy a place when the prices start to drop. How do you know when the bottom is going to hit?
Well, you don't. All you can do is hope to be near. You know, it's like Baron Rothschild said when he was talking about markets, the way to get rich, he said, you can have the first 20% of a market and the last 20%, and I'll take my 60% in the middle. I don't know where the actual bottom is. I do know, and my experience in the business and tells me that has honed my instincts to the point where it's almost like something you can almost feel. But I will tell you this, when the listing books get thinner, when homes are selling quickly and not taking very long, then you know that the markets are ready to turn around and go up. When the listing books are getting thicker and it's taking longer and longer to sell a home, well, then you know they're going to head down.
Well, that's true. Well, the stock market yet is an indicator that we're in trouble in the real estate market. It's gone over 11,000. It's at its highest rates ever. When is that going to slow down?
No. It's not at its highest rate ever. There's a number to remember, and it's 11,650.
All right.
Now, that was the all-time high. And when the stock market is in a bear market, it's going to last for probably an average of about 13 years, and have been going since 2000. Now, during bear markets, oftentimes the markets will come back and challenge the previous highs. The measure, I remember everybody was all excited about the so-called psychological barrier of 11,000. The stock market rose above it. That was important. No, it wasn't important. The important measure from a technical analysis point of view is, will it go to new highs that are confirmed by utilities and transports? And so this market is a long way from seeing those things happen, not a long way from seeing the new high, but a long way from the confirmations. It's not going to shake me out. I still believe we're in a bear market. I don't believe we're going to see new highs that are confirmed by these other indexes. Consequently, I'm hanging in there because I believe that this market is headed for somewhere around 4,000 on the Dow Jones, not 11,000.
4,000?
Yeah, sure.
And that's almost a collapse, isn't it?
Nope. That's just historically, when you've had a bear market, you have to get down to where price-earnings ratios are near what has historically been the bottom of bear markets. If when the average price-earnings ratio for that market reaches that point, the Dow will be around 4,000. And don't think that's impossible. For example, NASDAQ, that's bigger than the New York Stock Exchange now. When NASDAQ is down 55% from its highs of 2000. I mean, the world didn't end. It's just a lot of people got hurt, and the dot-com stocks are dot-gone.
But yeah, they are.
Yeah, I know, but that's not the end of the world. It's tough if you're bullish, and it's tough for Wall Street because if they can't be bullish, they don't make money because nobody buys stocks and they're bullish. And consequently, they're always bullish. They always have to be. It's just the very nature of their business. And incidentally, that's why they hate gold. Because when gold is rising, stocks decline.
And gold is rising.
That's historically been the case. But they will ignore gold because they're not about to admit that's happening, because it means they're admitting some bad things are going to happen to their pocketbooks, where they make their money, the stock market. So consequently, guys like me who turn bearish on or who turn bullish on gold, like I did after 22 years of being bearish, we're ignored. We're not respected because we're not a part of the team, and we're mavericks heading looking right when everybody's going left.
How high do you think gold can go, Howard?
Well, that's a hard one, but let me give you some guidelines.
All right.
Remember, gold went, in 1981 rose as high as 850.
Right.
Okay, it started down around 120, went to 850. Okay, I sold out 2 weeks before the peak, but at 750.
That's still pretty
top,
good.
But not the exact top, but close is good enough.
Yeah.
But if you were to adjust for inflation and simply bring it back to the same levels, adjusting for inflation, gold will go to around 2670. That's
wow.
Just to equal the last bull market. So are the forces that are creating this bull market greater than that? Yes, much, and we can talk about that a little later. Silver, for example, went to 50. Silver will not reach the same equivalent levels after adjusting for inflation that it did in 81 until silver is around 125. It's $10 now.
Now that's a huge jump.
Yeah, it is. It is a huge jump. But I think the essence of this story is that there are forces that drive those metals. They were not in existence, or at least not enough of them for me to be bullish on them. So, heck, even though I got accused of being a gold bug all these years, I was negative on the metals for 22 years. I even got sort of written out of the gold bug club, you know, the gold bug church for my heresy, because I thought it was a lousy investment. But when I turned bullish in December of 2003, and I'm very, very bullish now, I'm back in really kind of comfortable ground, because the forces are lined up in such a way that it's going to be very hard to be wrong about this one.
Would you rather invest in gold than the stock market right now if you had $10,000 to invest?
Well, it depends. If they're gold stocks, if gold mining stocks, sure. There are certain energy stocks that look good, alternative energy stocks. I like uranium and the uranium mining companies. I like coal mining companies. There's some places in the market that are going to look pretty good, but the market in general, the blue chips, the traditional investments in the market, I want out. And what's more, I don't like gold as well as I like silver, and we can talk about that, because silver has some very, very special things happening to it that can only drive the price way, way up.
Howard, my father worked all his life for the Ford Motor Company, all his life. And when he retired, you know, he had accumulated a pretty good sum of stock shares. And Ford in 1980s was doing pretty good. And, you know, I told him, I said, Dad, you got this great profit, sell it, put it in something else. And he said, nope, I love this company. So he hung in. He still has all those shares, Howard, but it's down to about $8 a share from a high of like 42.
Let me give you a story from the from way, way back. There was a man who died and left. He was rather wealthy, and he divided up his assets with his children, and they consisted of one stock. And his provision was that they would get the stock if they never sold it, because it was so solid. Well, this was in the 1920s, and the stock was the Pullman Railway Car Company.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Now, you can imagine what happened to it in the 30s.
Where is it?
Yeah. So nothing is forever. Nothing is forever. And to live in the past, and especially with those people who are old enough to have accumulated a lot of money and they still got their philosophy and their feet rooted in the past, they've got to move ahead. They've got to move into the world as it is now, not as it used to be.
Are you secure in the financial markets if there's another war, whether it's in Iran or any place else? Or do you think we're really in trouble then?
Well, it all depends on how serious the war is and whether or not war is attacking here. Now, gold and silver respond to war. They go up. How bad is the war? Does the monetary system hang together? I'll tell you what really worries me more than that. You know, way back, remember when we were negotiating to give away the Panama Canal?
Yes, the Carter administration did that.
They did that, and they appointed a guy by the name of Saul Linowitz as a negotiator, and
yes.
He was a member of the board of directors of Chemical Bank. He was appointed for one day less than 6 months, so he wouldn't have to be confirmed by the Senate, and then he went down to Panama to negotiate this giveaway. Now, set aside the fact that they were just trying to make sure that the canal revenues got to Torrijos, the dictator down there, so that they could make his loans good at their banks.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is that part of the deal was that the canal zone would be a free banking zone. And even before they finished the negotiation, which was one day before Saul Linowitz's term was up, there were bank buildings going up all over Panama. And nearly all of the international monetary operations were headquartered there. Now, what's happened now is that the dollar that used to be printed, you know, you think of the printing presses running and that causes inflation.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. Only 5% of our dollars are actually minted, printed, or coined. The rest of it is in cyberspace. They just don't exist physically. It moves
just a number somewhere.
It just moves like a keystroke. Okay, what if Al-Qaeda got some brilliant 17-year-old hackers, and these kids can be really good, and played on their ego and gave them money and said, hack into those programs. There's programs that have to have access to the outside world.
Sure.
Because they run the monetary system of the world. They really do run the monetary system of the world. In fact, bin Laden's attack on the World Trade Center, which he brought down, was an attempt to destroy the monetary system of the world because he thought the computers that run the monetary system were located there. He didn't know that many of them had been moved to Panama, and a lot of them had been moved across the river to New Jersey just a year before. But he had that objective. Now, what if these hackers were able to hack into the monetary system? They could the dollars, 95% of the world's dollars, could disappear in a nanosecond. What if they were able to hack into the power grid? They don't have to take out one or two pieces of it, and then the rest of it go like dominoes. And then you couldn't shop at the supermarkets with the electronically run cash registers because they couldn't open them. You couldn't get your money from an ATM. Now, what happens to gold and silver under those kinds of conditions in the worst case?
Goes through the roof.
Not only goes through the roof, but it might be the only spendable money there is because there's no dollars. So I have been recommending, and I hope everybody will listen to this, that everybody have at least one half bag of junk silver. Now, what that is the 90% dimes, quarters, and halves we used to make before 1965, and you can buy them by the bag or half bag.
You go to a bank?
Nope. You go to a coin dealer.
All right.
Any coin dealer, and the ones that I recommend, and I've been recommending for 25 years in my newsletter, where you know it's going to be safe, and you can commit and send them money, and they'll send you the coins. But when that happens, you have currency. You have dimes, quarters, and halves. And I think every family should have one half to one bag of that stashed away somewhere that they can get their hands on. That's insurance. It also differs from insurance in the insurance you buy for your life or your house or your car, the premiums are lost. They're gone, especially if you lose your bet and don't die or have an accident or your house doesn't burn down. That's losing your bet, and you lose your premium. But in this case, if you lose your bet, you've still got silver. You've still got silver that's saleable.
How much money is in these bags? How much do you have to convert?
It's $1,000 face value, and a bag, an amount of silver in it, about 750 ounces, goes right now for somewhere around $7,000 a bag, and a half bag about $3,500.
And what's the face value?
The face value is $1,000.
Isn't that a big drop? $3,500 for $1,000?
Well, $3,500 for $1,000 face value, but you're not buying them for face value. You're buying them for their silver.
Okay. Stay with us. Stay with us, Howard. We'll be back in a moment. Yeah, but getting a lot of requests for tapes of shows, the End Time Show and other programs. We don't provide tapes. However, here's a suggestion. I suggest you pick up StreamLink. It's considerably cheaper than what even one cassette tape would be. And then you can just do your own downloading of your own shows. How do you find StreamLink? Well, you go to the coasttocoastam.com website and read all about it. StreamLink, another great way to grab shows. You even get them podcasted right to you the next morning. So those of you who have always wanted tapes, I suggest StreamLink from Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Howard Ruff, our guest. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, give you an opportunity to chat with him as well. Let's go through the silver thing again here, Howard, for my simple mathematics. So we buy a bag. It's going to cost me how much? How much do I have to write from my checkbook?
One bag is going to be worth about $7,000. It's going to cost you about $7,000, yeah.
$7,000. And what's the silver value then of that bag?
That is the silver value. You're buying, the price is based on the silver value.
Oh, you buy on it. So it's just, so it's a wash, aside from a little fee, I guess, to the company that you buy the silver.
You'll pay the silver value plus a small premium. That's what the cost will be. And it's a moving target. It changes every day.
Okay. And so when it zooms and goes up, how do you dispose of it?
You sell it back to the coin dealer. There's always a market for them. These bags are traded widely, and in fact, a lot of them are being melted down into bullion because there's another factor here with silver. Silver supplies are disappearing.
Now, disappearing?
I'm saying that very advisedly. When I first started in this business back in the 70s, there was about 5 ounces of silver above ground in storage in government vaults in the industrial vaults and so forth, of about 5 ounces of silver for every ounce of gold. Now, there's about 5 ounces of gold for every ounce of silver, not because they've increased the amount of gold, but because the silver stockpile is disappearing. Now, why and how? Silver has become one of our most important industrial metals. In fact, it's used in more industrial applications than any other commodity except gasoline and oil. Now, for example, every computer screen, every flat screen TV uses silver. Every roll of film, every piece of glossy printing paper for your printing out your digital photographs, antifreeze. Every car has about 40 silver-tipped switches in it. It's a tremendous conductor, and it is now an absolutely indispensable industrial metal, and all of this industrial use, as it has grown and grown, has been eating up that inventory. At the same time, with the price of silver depressed as it was for 10 years, or for 22 years actually, the silver companies pulled in their horns and cut way, way back on exploration and development. As a result, there was less supply and increasing demand. And that is a formula for higher prices. That's why silver's gone from under $4 to about $10.50 as we speak today. But the world and the Wall Street has not yet waked up to the fact that in another year, all of the silver supplies will be gone and industrial use will use up every year about 150% of today's production. So with this amazing phenomenon, especially with the traders at the COMEX, Commodity Exchange in New York, having incredibly huge amounts of short contracts, and they're going underwater with, you know, as silver rises, they're losing money and their balance sheets are disappearing.
Sure.
They're in terrible trouble. And so that is a very, very bullish thing because they're going to have to buy to replace those contracts and to cut their losses, to cut the bleeding. So silver has, in the past bull market in the 70s, silver rose about twice as much as gold. Now, that was when we had surpluses of silver. Now that we're going to have monster shortages of silver and monster short positions, and incidentally, even the long position, the guys that are long, they're the producers, they're the ones that really need the metal. And they're buying it, they're long the metal so to protect themselves, so they got supplies. But the supplies are going to be gone. And if you own silver, especially if you own bullion, they're going to need yours. And consequently, that price is going to go up and up until you're willing to unload.
Realistically, Howard, how long should you hold your precious metal, whether it's gold or silver?
Well, you're going to hold them until it's time to sell them.
But I mean, I've always been told gold is a long-term hold. Is that true?
Yes and no. Long-term in that gold and silver bull markets last for some years, but it's not forever. Why do you think I was bearish for 22 years? It was a crummy investment during that time. The factors that drive it upward were gone. They were missing. Now, I'm going to hold, now that all the factors are lined up, and we can talk about what those factors are, I'm going to hold it until those factors change. And traditionally, the gold and silver bull markets last anywhere from 7 to 12 years. We're about 3 years into this one.
The Hunt family, when they tried to corner the market on silver years ago, was it their timing? What did they do wrong?
Oh, they didn't do anything wrong. Let me tell you what happened. I went to Houston to get an award for the worst economic decision of the year, and the creation of the Susan B. Anthony dollar, and they couldn't get Susan B. Anthony's daughter to go, and the National Organization of Women had never heard of her. So they called me and wanted me to come there and appear at this big meeting. They had press from all over the country, and so they were going to. I was going to tell them that the dollar was shrinking inside till eventually it slipped through the weave in your pockets, these Susan B. Anthony dollars. And Herbert Hunt was there. And Herbert Hunt is a subscriber to my newsletter, The Rough Times. And he came up to me, and I had just sold out, but I just told my subscribers to sell at $35, just about 2 weeks before the top. And he said, "Why did you tell everybody to sell out?" I said, "Because you're in a squabble with the COMEX. And when the elephants are fighting, the wee mice head for the underbrush." He said, "Oh, it's going to go to $100. That was a very dumb mistake."
Yeah.
And he kind of sneered at me and walked off. What happened is that these governors of the COMEX had done the same darn thing. They were all short the metals, and they had been bleeding as the metals went up and up, driven up by the Hunts. Now, they had to solve the problem, so they changed the rules. You could only go into the market if it was liquidation only. You couldn't buy. You could only sell. And they drove that market down. They broke the back of the Hunts. That's what happened to the Hunts. It was a battle between titans. And the titans that make the rules won. So that's what happened. I saw that happening. I saw that. I saw what the Volcker and Reagan were doing about reducing spending and cutting inflation. And I said, that's it. The gold and silver are trying to swim upstream against a strong current. They can't do it. I'm out of here. I'm one of the mice. I'm heading for the underbrush.
That's a smart move, though. Did the Hunts get wiped out, or how badly did they get hit?
Oh, it's hard to say. You never hear about them. I don't think they got wiped out, but, boy, they had a huge percentage of their net worth tied up in it. And incidentally, what's his name? I'm trying to think of the world's biggest investor.
Warren Buffett?
Yeah, Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is by far the world's largest holder of physical silver. He has bought it and bought it and bought it, and he has thousands of ounces, millions of ounces of silver that he's bought for his own account and for his business accounts. He knows the same things I'm talking about. He's seen the supply-demand figures.
Why are you at the point where you are now? I mean, did you study this when you were younger? I mean, you're pretty intuitive, and you go with your gut a lot, but you're pretty darn smart too, Howard. What made Howard Ruff?
Oh, just lucky, I guess. I trained to be an opera singer.
You trained to be an opera singer?
Yeah, I planned for that as soon as my voice changed. I majored in music and conducting as a student at Brigham Young University. I had a modest singing career. I was a soloist and announcer with the Air Force Band and singing sergeants for 4 years, traveled all over the world and entertained heads of state and historical characters like the Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chong and that sort of thing. I was on the Ed Sullivan Show a couple times. I was pretty good. I just wasn't good enough. There were only about 2,000 baritones making a living, and I was like in the 3,000. and so we were struggling.
You sang with the Osmonds once, didn't you?
Pardon?
Didn't you sing with the Osmonds?
Well, I made an album in 80, and I used the Osmond Brothers and the BYU Philharmonic and Acapella Choir as my backup groups. And, yeah, they did. And we did old war horses, like You'll Never Walk Alone, where the Osmond Brothers joined me in the chorus, and My Way, and Climb Every Mountain, and If I Were a Rich Man. It was a lot of fun to do that. And, in fact, we give a copy of that CD to every new subscriber to my newsletter. But that's how I started. But when I was in the Singing Sergeants in Washington, D.C., it was government work. I only had to report for a couple hours a day for rehearsals. So I got a job as a stockbroker on the side. And I'd gotten terribly interested in government. I was the two senators from Utah became friends of mine, and I used to go down to lunch at the Capitol, at the Senate, the dining room, and then go listen to the debates. And I got interested in economics, interested in investments, interested in government, and that changed my life. It really did change my life. And so, it's a long story, and there's more detail. In fact, I tell the story in that book that you referred to at the beginning of the show. But the essence of it is that I evolved in a direction I never anticipated. I became a writer, and I skipped freshman English at BYU for 3 years because I hated to write. Who would have thought I'd ever be a writer? And then I wrote a book that sold 3 million copies.
That's right. It was a bestseller.
It's the biggest financial bestseller ever sold. And it was just a dumb luck. So I guess the answer to your question is just lucky, I guess.
Well, that's pretty good luck. But, behind luck, there's always some brilliance, and I think you've got some.
Well, I'm pretty humble about it, though,
The rough times, you're still doing that?
Oh, yes, I'm doing that. It's about three-quarters of our subscribers are on the Internet. And, in fact, anybody who's interested in looking into it can go to my website, which is roughtimes.com.
And that's spelled R-U-F-F.
Yeah, R-U-F-F, roughtimes.com. And it'll tell them a lot more than they'd ever want to know about Howard Ruff. And our subscribers, about three-quarters of them get it by email every 3 weeks. But, I'm doing that because I can't quit. I mean, I'm 75 years old. I've got 65 grandchildren. We've got 14 kids.
Did you say you have 65 grandchildren?
Yeah, we do. And our first great-grandchild just arrived.
That's great. Well,
it was a horrible moment. I woke up and realized I was laying there one morning next to a great-grandmother. Man,
Yeah, what do you think she was laying next to, for crying out loud?
Didn't think about that.
No, how about that?
No.
She put up with you for all these years, right?
I think it's the other way around. I mean, I'm married to a saint. You realize how hard it is to be married to a saint? My wife is a saint.
That's true. That's true. Well, you're good people, Howard. And,
well, I don't know. We have. She bore 9 children, and we adopted 5. Adopted them as teenagers, and so we're into family. We're into kids, and that's very important to us. That and our religion. Where I'm practicing Mormon, I'm going to keep practicing until I get it right. And so church and family are the center of my life. I'm not going to allow myself to get so wrapped up in money that I will forget the things that are far, far more important. And there are a lot of things more important than money.
I wish other people, even people that are running governments, would say the same thing. I have a feeling money has tainted this country to a point now, Howard, where our moves for America are based on profits for some. And I think it's going to get us in serious trouble.
Well, let me tell you what I think the solution is. Ignore government. Plan your life so you don't need government. You don't care about government. You don't care if they give you Social Security. Plan your life so that you're planning for your own retirement, so that you're saving, so that you're investing appropriately at the right time, so you're catching the great waves and movements like the stock market was back before the dot-coms. So for several years before then, that's where we were. We were in the stock market. Now we're in the gold and silver market. My job is to catch major trends, major swings, somewhere near the beginning of them. And if you do that, and if you have the guts and the strength of your convictions, you will be able to prepare yourself so you don't care what the rest of the world does. It doesn't matter to you. I mean, what if Al-Qaeda smuggles a nuclear bomb into America? It's going to be a real problem, but financially we'll be okay because we're going to have gold and silver coins.
Howard, what would you recommend to a young family? They make their mortgage payment, they make their car or car payments, they've got a couple kids, and maybe they can squeeze out $300 or $400 a month to put in the bank. What do you suggest they do with that money? $300 or $400?
Well, no, I won't suggest they do something with $300 or $400. I'd say they increase it to $700 or $800 or $900 by getting themselves out of debt, so they're not having to put their money into debt payments, but can put it into savings. Now, there's a chapter in that book you referred to that talks about compound interest, which is a double-edged sword. When it's working against you, it eats you alive when you're paying it. When you're earning it, it's one way to become very safely prosperous. And I think when I get someone like that, I worry about their car payments. I think people should own an older used car they can pay for in full. It'll so they can sit down and so they can travel in seated in comfort and air-conditioned comfort. I think they should have a smaller house. My wife and I, we went through it all. I mean, I had a $20,000 home and a 10-acre estate at one time, and I thought that was pretty important. Well, that was stupid. Now we have a nice home. It's nice, but it's not a mansion. It's just very, very nice. And it's we own free and clear.
Though I'm sure you could afford a mansion, not to get into your personal financials, but, you know, Howard Ruff has done well. So your mindset is you don't want to waste the money.
No, but as a matter of principle, and I'm really talking principles here, as a matter of principle, I want what's necessary for my comfort. I don't need a Mercedes 750. Heck, I'm happy. I got really extravagant and got myself an Avalon, a 2003 Avalon, used. And I love that car. I mean, it's the best car I ever owned. I buy used because I'm just as comfortable with a wonderful 2003 Avalon XLS as I would be with a brand new one. I'll pay about half as much for it.
You got to get to the point where you just don't care what other people say, because this keeping up with the Joneses is another reason why people are in the debt so badly.
Well, let me tell you, you drive down through the neighborhood and you're through a nice neighborhood. Maybe you live in a nice neighborhood and you're up your eyeballs in debt and worrying about how you're going to make the payments. But you're looking at the Joneses and they've got a boat in the driveway and they've got a great big house. And they say, boy, they must be rich. No, they're not. You're not judging how rich they are. You're judging how much they're in debt. They yeah. might be, you know, the philosopher said that the mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. And I think that's very much true today. I think there are people living lives of quiet desperation that you have no idea. And you think they're rich, but they're struggling. And the real estate decline is going to create real problems for them because they're living close to the hilt as it is. And then when their mortgage payments go up with interest rates, which one of my forecasts is rising interest rates over the next several years, they're going to find they can't make their payments, and they're not going to be able to sell because the market has gotten sick. And what's more, if they did, they'd be underwater. They wouldn't be able to pay off the mortgage. And consequently, all of these factors working together are going to hurt the people that are in debt, but the people who own their property free and clear are going to be fine. Just won't matter. They'll just make their payments.
I see a guy pedaling on his bicycle here in St. Louis all the time when I'm here, and I say to myself, you know what? That guy's got his act together. He doesn't have to worry about a big car payment. He's got his bicycle. It gets him to where he has to go. He obviously doesn't live too far, and he's happy. And you know what? He's also in shape.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in shape. Well, I spent 2.5 months in the hospital this summer with heart surgery, and I'm complicated by an infection. And I will tell you this, that I decided I'm never going back there again, so I'm getting in shape. I got a personal trainer. I'm working out 3 times a week. I'm going to get in shape. It's a little late in life to do that, but, hey, it's making a difference. It makes a difference in the way I feel.
Good for you. Hey, you tell your doctor, too. You tell your cardiologist you want to get a calcification check. It's a simple test now. It's machinery that most hospitals have, especially where you live. And they can tell you how much calcium you have in your arteries, and then you can combat that and go right after it.
Yeah, I've been taking a chelation program, which is helping clear the calcium out of my arteries.
Good.
And then I'll be going in for a calcium check to see how effective it has been. But I'm not going back in that hospital. That was a hideous experience.
I don't blame you. Stay with us, Howard. We're going to open up the phone lines. Our guest is Howard Ruff. Talk to him about anything financial you want. Last hour, Alex Jones pops in. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.